This is the second of a group of sermons based on the book of James, a strange letter made up of haphazardly arranged bits and pieces of advice on different topics. Three times in his brief letter, James, whoever he is, we don't know, gets going on the topic of wealth. First, with a stern warning, then with that sarcastic crack at snobbery that young Matthew Milton read so well, and finally, an eruption of steam and red-hot lava which almost scorches the page. We talked last Sunday of how important it is in reading the Bible to know the context out of which an author speaks. We need to know more of this man's experience with rich and powerful people, because read in America in 1986, some of what he says will seem terribly biased and unfair. He reminds me of one long, memorable Sunday afternoon in Hyde Park in London when I went from one soapbox orator to another to hear not calm and sober discussion, but passionate propaganda about each speaker's favorite topic. James is on a soapbox, screaming his head off about his grudge against people with money and power. He insults and abuses these people until we feel that there must have been some terrible experience pushing his pen. It's true that Christ was remembered as having said that riches could bring great risk, but he also apparently enjoyed the company of a few wealthy friends. And in a parable or two, he accepts the idea of working hard to make money. One deduces from his words a message that says something like this: there are special temptations for those of great wealth. Be careful to use what you have for good, and don't let the power of money tempt you into arrogance and a hard heart. But James seems to reflect a later time in the Christian experience when no one was to be trusted who had a sizable bank account. Let's hear his opening shot, in which he says that the poor brother can be proud of his high standing with God, while the rich one can be grateful if he gets kicked around until he comes to his senses. For the rich man, he says, will wither away as surely as summer flowers. One day the sunrise brings a scorching wind, the grass withers at once, and so do all the flowers. All that lovely sight is destroyed. Just as surely will the rich man and all his extravagant ways fall into the blight of decay. He really almost seems happy about it. When the sirocco comes, that hot east wind in Palestine that could burn a landscape from green to brown in a single day, when that happens, he says, the beauty of a flower gives it no protection. So despite his impressive appearance, everything that protects him in social relationships, the rich man will wither in the midst of all his doings. James is not happy with rich people. Don't you get the feeling already that he would not be able to approve of any rich person at all. It seems simply not in the world of his experience to think that a woman might inherit wealth and then use it with great wisdom to help others, or that someone might work hard and honestly and use great profits to create jobs. He is so far removed from our world, in fact, that he sounds impractical. It seems unreal and hypocritical to agree with him when all of us would dearly love to be the very thing he puts down. I think we're not always honest about this matter. It's great fun to sit around and talk about how much danger the rich man faces and how he'll be sorry someday to have had it so good. But it's almost always pure hypocrisy, because not one in a million of us would turn down a fortune if it were offered. If a genuine offer came to me tomorrow of a $50 million gift, do you think I would be likely to say, "Thanks, but I'm really not interested. I've been reading the book of James, and I know how bad it is to be rich. Just keep it." What would cross my mind, probably, is that God really does bless the deserving after all. And what I would say is something like this: "Now at last I can do some of the good and decent things I've always wanted to do." Then I would bask in a double joy for a while: the joy of getting the money in the first place, and the joy of feeling righteous about what I meant to do with it. And then when the exhilaration of all that power hit me, what I would actually do would probably not bear much resemblance to anything I had promised. So when we hear James giving vent to his hostility toward the rich, let's be honest about our own feelings and how much we covet that. God can do something with honesty, hypocrisy is pretty hopeless. I'm sure we'd all be a little more comfortable with James if he could just lighten up a little. Maybe a joke or two about the great inequities in human life. They do exist, after all. And they do seem unfair. And there are two ways to handle that, either with anger or with a joke. James prefers to be angry. You have the feeling that he couldn't make a joke about wealth to save his life. Not even a rather grim joke, like an old one I read last week, which must go back to the 1930s. "There are many in this world of ours," somebody said, "who hold that things break about even for all of us. I have observed, for example, that we all get the same amount of ice. The rich get it in the summertime, and the poor get it in the winter." We smile, and the inequities become a little more bearable. But for James, they are painful, and only painful. And so in his second section on wealth, he describes a kind of snobbery he obviously detests. A rich man comes to church with a gold ring on his finger, a Roman nobleman, perhaps, dressed in a white toga, aristocratic, impressive. And at the same service, a poor man arrives in worn and faded blue jeans. Somebody gets up in this little Sunday morning drama and offers a comfortable seat with a footstool to the rich man, and then says to the other, stand there, or sit on the floor. Why would you do this? James asks his audience. Isn't it always the rich who are against you? Isn't it always their doing? When you are in trouble and you lose, I am in trouble, when you are dragged before the court, aren't they the ones who insult that honorable name to which you have been dedicated? Apparently, James thought all rich people made fun of the name of Christ. Again, I wish we had the context out of which this came. It seems to reflect a more violent relationship between rich and poor than most of us have known. And yet the difference is not so great that we miss the point of James entirely. I remember that moment in fairly recent history when a man named Gandhi, coming out of a caste system which he deplored, in South Africa, visiting early in his career, went to a Christian church where a friend of his, an English preacher by the name of C.F. Andrews, was to speak. An usher turned Gandhi away from the door because of the color of his skin. Discrimination and snobbery are not total strangers to us, even in the churches where we worship. We may not block the door, but we have subtle ways of making it clear who fits and who doesn't. And if the power of money had made James angry, it still bothers us when that power breeds unfairness. If you know the justice system, if you so much as read the daily paper, you know that if you have money to hire the best attorney, your chances for acquittal in a trial rise dramatically. Compared with most others, our system is superb in many ways, but one would have to be blind not to know how differently justice may be meted out depending on one's economic status. I don't know all the details of, say, John DeLorean's scheme to rebuild his empire, but I am fully convinced that men without money to hire famous lawyers and without beautiful wives to impress a jury are now in prison for less skullduggery than John appeared to be guilty of. Maybe a little of that kind of imbalance was already showing up by the time James wrote, because his final blast is so one-sided that when Upton Sinclair read it one day to some ministers, after he had told them that it was written by an anarchist agitator, they were incensed and said the writer should be told to leave the country at once. Even ministers don't read James very often, I think. You will be able to understand why they were upset when I read it to you now in a clear, modern translation. And now, you plutocrats, now is the time for you to weep and howl because of the miseries in store for you. Your wealth is all rotting. Your clothes are all eaten up by moths. All your gold and your silver are corroding away. And the same corrosion will be your own sentence and eat into your body. You may want to stop James in midstream and tell him that gold doesn't corrode, but it wouldn't matter. He is far beyond that kind of logic. What his rich people were really storing up he says, was not what they hoped they were storing up. They thought they'd have treasure to take care of them tomorrow. But instead, he says, their wealth is a burning fire that will only consume them. And then he gets specific. Laborers mowed your fields, and you cheated them. Listen to the wages that you kept back. Listen to how they call out the truth about your wickedness. Realize that the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord himself. On earth, you had a life of comfort and luxury. In the time of slaughter, you went on eating to your heart's content. It was you who condemned the innocent and killed them. They offered you no resistance. I wish we knew the terrible context out of which that blanket condemnation has come. What I've just read is probably not the text we would choose for the next annual Chamber of Commerce banquet. We get the feeling that James and his friends must have experienced some awful suffering at the hands of rich and powerful families who cheated their employees and killed even the innocent who had no power to resist them. I wish we knew what had happened to make this man lump all wealthy people together in a way so stubbornly hostile. The truth is, however annoying it may be nowadays to hear such things in our great capitalistic society, early Christian sermons went pretty much the same. Clement of Alexandria sounds like a late first century socialist. I know that God has given us the use of goods, but only as far as is necessary. It is absurd and disgraceful for one to live magnificently and luxuriously when so many are hungry. And 150 years later, the famous preacher named Ambrose said to his audience, "How far, O rich, do you extend your senseless avarice? Do you intend to be the sole inhabitants of the earth? The earth was made for all, the rich and poor, in common. Why do you rich men claim it as your exclusive right?" So you see, long before Marx and Lenin, the Christian church was agonizing over the great disparities between rich and poor and wondering how to deal with them in a different kind of kingdom. Saint Bernard criticized the medieval church of the 12th century like this: the great age of cathedral building and ostentatious display of wealth. He said, "The church is resplendent in her walls, beggarly in her poor. She clothes her stones in gold and leaves her sons naked." There were reasons why Lenin was able to get people to listen to him when he said at the start of this century, "Religion teaches those who toil in poverty all their lives to be resigned and patient in this world and consoles them with the hope of a reward in heaven." Religion, he thought, was a tool used by the rich to keep themselves on top and to placate the poor. We haven't solved the problems yet that are tied in with the great distances between rich and poor, and it won't help for any of us to say, well, thank goodness this is one thing I don't have to worry about. God knows I'm not rich. Trouble is, all of us are. All of us in this room are rich. Perhaps not when you measure us by the Hunts and the Gettys, but beyond all doubt, when you measure us against most of the rest of humanity. I am myself fabulously wealthy when my life is set over against the lives of millions of Indians and Chinese and third world people who would stare in disbelief at the luxuries of even my modest house. So I have to deal with the very problem James brings up, even if I think he overstates it, and even if he seems to be writing out of certain experiences that I have not shared. I have to remember that my wealth, enormous if I look in the right direction when I measure it, my wealth can pose a threat to character. I can grow proud. I can forget how ultimately dependent I am. I can become impatient with those who do not serve me quickly enough. I can begin to feel that what I have is, after all, only what I have deserved. So even through the hyperbole and the violence of his passion, James can still speak a sobering message. Next week, a much quieter word from him. In one short sentence, he has three good bits of advice. Small pieces of wisdom of the kind you might expect from someone like Will Rogers. Please come back and let this uncompromising gentleman speak to us again.